from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The boy born Richard Melville Hall was a devout Christian, vegan, straight, suburban white kid when he hit the New York club scene in the late 1980s. A DJ drawn to trance and rave. When his ascent in that world took off, the world would know him as Moby, a pioneer of electronic dance music and global star. This hour on Point, Moby is with us in the studio sharing that journey. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you raved with Moby? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. For the first time today, we are video live streaming this show via Facebook Live. Check it out on Facebook at On Point Radio. You can see it all and give us questions there, too. With me now in the studio is Moby, singer-songwriter, DJ, musician. He's sold over 20 million albums worldwide. Put out dozens of albums, including the huge hit album in 1999, Play, plus 18, Innocence, and more. He's out with a new memoir going back to his early days in New York. It is titled Porcelain. You can read an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. Moby, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi. Great to have you here.
It's nice to be here. I'm a little bit heavily caffeinated because... We got here a little early, and I've just been sitting in the commissary drinking the free coffee.
All right. We can work with that. It sounds like the tune behind us here had a little bit of that maybe going on as well.
Yeah, I haven't heard that in such a long time.
You used to, what, 1992 you came out with that? You used to open shows with that, if I'm right.
Yeah, from about 1991 to even like 95 or 96, that was the first song I ever played. For every live set I did, that was my opening song. And so hearing that, it was like this mnemonic trigger. And even though I'm 50 years old and it's 2016, when I first heard that, I felt like I was walking on stage at a rave in 1992.
Describe the world you came from and the world you came into when you moved from Darien, Connecticut, into the club scene of Manhattan.
Well, so I was born in Harlem. And then my mom had grown up in Connecticut. So in around 1968, we moved back to Connecticut, to Darien, where she had grown up. Mm-hmm. And I always have to qualify this by saying that I grew up in Darien, Connecticut, but we were poor white trash, which is not necessarily what people think of when they think of Darien, Connecticut.
Quite upscale community, but that wasn't your place in that community.
Yeah, we were on food stamps and welfare until I was 18. So until I was 18 years old, I had never met another poor person.
Only yourself.
Yeah, me and my mom and some of her friends. But like all of my friends growing up in Connecticut were very, very wealthy. And I just assumed that that was the natural order of things. Like everyone else in the world was wealthy and my mom and I were really poor.
You're famous for your music, for trance, for DJing, for rave. But I love the story you tell right off the beginning. You just paint a picture of yourself. You're 50 now. You were 10 years old. And I wonder if you can read just a picture of a sort of evening in the life of young Moby.
So briefly, my mom and I lived in Stratford, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And so this is the beginning of my book, Porcelain. All the stores at the Dock Mall in Stratford, Connecticut were closed for the night, except for the fresh and clean laundromat. My mom was inside the laundromat, wearing blue jeans and a brown winter jacket that she bought at the Salvation Army for $5. She stood at a cracked linoleum counter underneath flickering fluorescent lights, smoking a Winston cigarette and folding clothes. Some of the clothes were ours and some belonged to our neighbors, who sometimes would pay us to wash and fold their laundry. On this March night, the storefronts were dark. The parking lot was empty except for our old silver Chevy Vega and one other car. The cold was wet and heavy, and the piles of snow in the corners of the parking lot had turned gray and were melting in the rain. Every 2 weeks, I'd find myself at the dock doing laundry with my mom. I would help her or just sit on the fiberglass shell chairs in the laundromat and watch the giant dryers spinning in their fast, lopsided way. My mom had been unemployed for over a year, and her last relationship had ended when her boyfriend tried to stab her to death. Sometimes I would find her crying while she folded the neighbor's clothes. She would be folding furiously, a cigarette lodged in her mouth, tears falling onto the neighbor's T-shirts, and I was 10 years old.
Moby, reading from the very opening of his new memoir, Porcelain. You go on to describe there how you would go out to the old, it was a Chevy Vega your mom was driving then, you get tired of watching you, say, smoke and fold clothes and cry, made the poverty seem the more vicious. And in the car, to kill time, you would be spinning the dial back and forth on the AM radio.
Oh, obsessively. I mean, radio, because I grew up very poor in the suburbs, and to be honest, I hated it. You know, I mean, I'm sure that there are some people listening who also grew up poor in the suburbs. And like, the suburbs can be a really nice place if you're affluent or if you fit in. But growing up poor...
On that rainy night when your mom is smoking a Winston and folding the clothes at the laundromat and nothing's nice.
And you have to borrow money to go to Cumberland Farms to buy milk. And so it's grim, you know, going to school every day. And I'm not necessarily complaining. I'm just saying it was...
Just the way it was.
It was kind of grim, going to school wearing secondhand clothes that still sort of smelled like Salvation Army.
The $5 coat, winter coat your mom had bought.
Yeah.
You describe your damp Wrangler blue jeans sticking to the vinyl of the cold car. You're listening. And this song comes on from Diana Ross. And you say it's a kind of a, it seems like kind of a rosebud key to Moby. Let's hear it. Love Hangover by Diana Ross.
I've got the sweetest hangover.
Diana Ross, Love Hangover, 10-year-old Moby listening to that out in the Wrangler. You said the opening was languid, otherworldly, seductive, and it scared me.
Well, I don't know if you had this experience or if anyone else did, but growing up in the 70s, there was a lot of sexual innuendo in popular culture,
yep.
And it terrified me. You know, so I'd be watching The Love Boat with my mom, and there'd be some sort of sexual innuendo, and it would make me so uncomfortable. Or the song Afternoon Delight would come on the radio, and I would just be like, please make this song end, because I don't know what sex is, but I know that this song is about sex, and it makes me really uncomfortable.
This was because you were a kid? Because you were a kid who'd been raised fairly devoutly Christian? Why exactly do you think?
Ah, that's a good question. I mean, maybe it's just like the legacy of New England Calvinism, like just discomfort around anything sexual or sensual, but... Then I heard this song, because I was obsessed with the radio when I was growing up, and would listen to Casey Kasem's American Top 40 religiously, and I loved everything about the radio, especially the fact that it represented worlds that were not poor suburban Connecticut.
Can we hear, let's go right on then, you know, sort of flash forward here, 1990, a remix of Go. This is from the Woodtick mix. Really kicked off your career, and I wonder if somewhere in here is the sound of Love Hangover and Diana Ross. I don't know. Moby's Go, the Woodtick Mix, 1990 single, sampled the theme song from the TV show Twin Peaks. It was incredibly popular overseas, especially. Can you trace it back? Is there something of that early radio listening that's right here in our ears?
Probably, because when I was growing up, I grew up studying classical music, and then when I was in high school, I started playing in punk rock bands. But I had grown up with an obsession for anything futuristic, you know, whether it was Star Trek or Space 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And also somewhere encoded in my DNA was a weird love of disco. Because growing up in the 70s, if you listened to the radio, you heard Donna Summer, you heard Diana Ross. And so I think, I mean, so there in that song Go is like the suburban strangeness of David Lynch coupled with a very feminine disco ethos. So clearly... That was, you know, sort of encoded into my DNA in the 70s.
And trance, right there in that rhythmic repetition, 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 repetition. What do you think took you to that? I love trance music, and I can't explain why I do. What is it that took you to it? What has brought so many to it?
That's a really good question. I mean, I can only think of it almost in a sort of atavistic way, that... Our ancestors,
from the dawn of time.
Yeah, people have been, I mean, if we go back...
Chant and repeat.
Yeah, 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, our ancestors were building fires and dancing around the fires, clapping and banging on sticks and chanting, usually, I'm assuming, quite repetitively. So it's almost, again, something that has this sort of like It's like an atavistic trigger, you know, something that we've been doing for millennia.
When you were early days DJing in New York, could you see that in the crowd? Could you work them in the way a shaman might work his, I don't know, his village somewhere in Asia, Africa, Europe?
And you can feel that. There's that symbiotic relationship with an audience where, and I'm sure that everyone has had, many people probably had that experience, either being a musician or a DJ or being in the audience, when all of a sudden things coalesce, you know, when the music feels perfect and the lights are perfect, and it doesn't necessarily even have to be drug related, but suddenly you feel less like an individual and more like a part of this pulsing group of people. And when that happens, I mean, I think that's why people keep going out to raves and people keep going out to nightclubs, for that moment of like, yeah, I don't know, gregarious coalescing.
Doesn't have to be drug related, though eventually, of course, maybe from the beginning, it often was. We'll talk a lot about that. Moby is with me, descended from Herman Melville. We'll talk about that as well. Author of Moby Dick. Not descended, but he was a great, great, great something uncle of yours.
Yeah.
Hold the thought. Moby is with me in the studio. We are Facebook live streaming. If you're on Facebook, you can be right there with us visually, and you can join us this hour. Have you raved with Moby? Put on his music and just let loose, gotten lost. What's your question about where he came from, who he is? What did trance music, rave, techno, that whole thing mean to you? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Tom Ashbrook with Moby in the studio. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point with DJ techno rocker star Moby in the studio today. We're talking about God, sex, veganism, trance, raves, and how he came up in New York City in the 1990s. He's out with a new memoir, it's pretty terrific, called Porcelain. You can find an excerpt of that at our website, onpointradio.org. And for the first time today, you can watch this whole show. It's on right now, Facebook live streaming. Check it out. Moby is with me in the studio. Have you raved with Moby? What did, does trance music, rave, techno, that whole thing mean to you? Were you, are you part of the techno clubbing scene? What does Moby mean to that scene? What's your question for Moby? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Behind us right here, Feeling So Real, off of the album Everything Is So Wrong, 1994. A hit on U.S. dance charts. Calls it in his book, his beautiful rave anthem that was, quote, huge and joyful and full of longing. Take us back to the time when you were putting together Feeling So Real.
So it was 1994, which I can't believe that was 22 years ago.
Yes, sir.
That doesn't seem possible. I was thinking the other day.
That's a chunk of a human life right there, 22 years.
I was thinking the other day. I remember being 10 years old. I guess I would have been in fifth grade or sixth grade. And I was sitting in class and watch, you know, I don't know what we were doing. This was in Connecticut, like in elementary school. And I imagined to myself, I said, at some point, the year 2000 will happen. And it seemed
so far away.
Inconceivably far away. I was like, that could never happen. It was 1976. I was like, there will never be a year 2000 because, and then I tried to imagine that I would be 34 in the year 2000. And that even seemed inconceivable. Yeah. And so now it's 2016, and 2000 is 16 years in the past. So, like, we're talking about 1994.
Yes, stretching the time.
It's just, I still have a hard time wrapping my head around it. But writing Feeling So Real. So in 1994, the dance scene, especially the rave scene, in the early 90s had been very euphoric.
Yeah.
The music was euphoric. the drugs people were taking were euphoric. I don't know if we're allowed to talk about
yes,
that.
Yes, we are. It's okay. A fact.
I'm not advocating anything because I'm a sober, straight edge person. But like in the early 90s, people, everything was euphoric in the dance scene. And then there was a shift in around 1993 and people replaced their ecstasy with ketamine, Special
mm-hmm.
K.
Okay.
And the music got darker and the entire scene got darker. And so I wrote this song, Feeling So Real, sort of as almost like a wake-up call to myself and hopefully to other people to remind people that electronic music could be celebratory, that it could be joyful.
Hang on to the joy.
You know, it was almost also in 1993 when things were getting darker, they were also becoming much more masculine.
Yeah.
And even though I'm a straight white guy, I always loved celebratory, you know, more feminine African-American music.
You talk a lot about that in the book, this sort of female energy that you wanted to tap
yeah.
into.
It's like maybe it's also a byproduct of growing up in New England, yeah. you know, because New England does tend sometimes be a little rigid and patriarchal.
Okay.
And when I heard...
Just a little, maybe, yeah. sometimes.
When I started hearing like African-American, more feminine dance music, it really resonated with me.
Before we go deeper into the dark, let's go back to some more of that, like 1992, you brought out Next is the E. This is off of your album, Moby. Hit on the Hot Dance Music chart. You write in the book that it became a rave anthem for 92 before the scene got darker. Next is the E. Next is the E. Where did you come up with that little voice? Next is the E. Is it a child's voice? Is that you? What is it?
It's from an old, obscure hip-hop record from about 1984.
Yeah.
It's from on some obscure label, I think from Florida. So I don't know. My approach to sampling, and I don't advocate this, but my approach was always to sort of like seek forgiveness rather than permission. So it's like sample something, and if someone finds out about it, yeah. well, then you have to pay them for it. But I just never really troubled me too much where the samples were actually coming from, which has legally gotten me in a lot of trouble over the years.
just go. You were young. You were making it happen.
Yeah.
I love these conversations about how it all begins. I mean, on that microphone, on this show, you know, Elvis Costello and Grandmaster Flash and Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys and mm-hmm. Lou Reed and Wilco and Patti Smith and Joe, lots of people. We learn a lot when we dip in, and you dip in so deeply in the memoir, Porcelain. I've got questions. We've got callers for you. Marcus in Dayton, Ohio, you are on with Moby.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Hello, Moby.
Hi.
I'm calling purely as a fan. I was a young kid watching my older sister go on to these shows in the early 90s, and by the late 90s, I was able to take myself, and to see you on the flyer was amazing, and to see you live was amazing, and these past few years in Detroit that you played, and Detroit's coming up next week, it's just a pleasure to speak with you and just to tell you thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Big thanks from Dayton, Ohio. Nothing but pleasure and thanks. Let's get one more. Ian in Westerly, Rhode Island. Ian, you're on the air with Moby.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say something that kind of supports what you guys just brought up about the kind of atavistic quality. And it relates to one of the Matrix films. There's a scene, this underground kind of culture that's surviving, and this rave that's going on. And I remember the first time I saw the scene, you know, I'm an otherwise pretty normal 50-year-old guy, but I really connected with it. And I feel the same thing with Moby's music.
Oh, thank you very much. That makes me really happy to hear.
Did you see
the scene?
Oh, I remember the scene very, very well. It was the second one, the Wachowski brothers, or Wachowski, are they still brothers? My gender language, I'm not sure. But yeah, I remember the scene very, very well. And I remember being surprised at how accurate it was. I mean, clearly they had spent some time at Burning Man, mm-hmm. but also how they stayed there for so long. Like I thought they would have this glancing reference to the rave scene. Mm-hmm. And instead they had, it felt like a 5-minute long rave yeah. in the middle of the second Matrix
really
movie.
Immersed.
Yeah.
Did that look commonplace to you by the time Matrix came out? Oh, yeah. Or did that look like they were taking people, you somewhere?
What was interesting is clearly there have been a lot of depictions of rave culture in the media, but this was so loving. Like, it was just clear that the Wachowski brothers had spent a lot of time in this culture and had had some really profound experiences.
I want to go to, you've got all flavors here and some just so moving. 1994, also off of Everything Is Wrong, God Moving Over the Face of the Waters. You describe putting this together, and if I recall right, you describe sort of weeping at the end of putting this together.
Yeah.
Let's listen. God Moving Over the Face of the Waters from Moby. Moving Over the Face of the Waters. Love this song. Completely different feel. You're clearly not in this just for kicks or just for the sort of techno rhythmic buzz. What moved you to this song?
Well, I had grown up listening to a lot of classical music. And when I first started playing music, I was studying music theory and playing classical guitar. And my mom had been a classical pianist. So just as disco and punk rock are encoded in my musical DNA, classical music is there as well. And I'd also had a lot of appreciation for what we'll call like serial classical music, like Steve Reich, even some Philip Glass, things that were that had a sort of repetitive quality
to them.
Sounds
very Philip Glass right there.
And the idea of, I write about in the book Porcelain, I write about coming up with this piece of music. And at the time, my record label just wanted me to be a dance artist. But I was making my first album, and I had never, even for a second, thought that I would be in a position to make an album. I thought I was going to spend my entire life laboring in obscurity, making music that no one ever listened to. So I was making my first album, and I simply thought I wanted to put as many different genres on this record as possible. So on the album, Everything Is Wrong, there's... there are rave anthems, there's punk rock songs, there's ballads, and then there's a couple pieces of quiet classical music.
You write that you imagined God actually creating the world.
Yeah.
You also write about being raised Christian, devoutly Christian, and then moving into this sort of wild scene in New York. How do those things all fit together? Is part of that youth coming out in this, or something else, a more adult sensibility?
I don't know, because, I mean, for example, the vision, when I was writing that piece of music, I did have this image of the Earth, and this is going back 4 billion years, 5 billion years, the beginning of the Earth when, you know, as far as we know from science, the Earth was just covered in water. But then you read the beginning of, and I'm not a religious person at all at this point. I self-identify as like a Taoist, Sufi, lover of the teachings of Christ, fan of quantum mechanics,
etc.
But in the beginning of Genesis, they talk about God moving over the face of the waters, and the earth was without form and void.
Yes.
Which is actually a pretty good description of what was going on 5 billion years ago.
Yeah.
And so I just had this idea of assuming the existence of a divine entity, of this divine entity flying over the face of the waters, imagining everything that was about to happen. You know, imagining having this prescient foresight and being able to see...
It's God, after all.
...billions of years of life and death and suffering and longing and joy and sadness and, like, the enormity of that. And clearly, one piece of music cannot in any way encapsulate that, but that was what was going through my head as I was writing that piece of music.
Moby, brave enough to take a stab at that, and it's pretty darn beautiful. Mark, in Detroit, you're on the air with Moby. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hello, Moby. It's a pleasure to speak with you both. Wanted to mention, when I saw you here live in Detroit at the State Theater, I don't know, about a decade or so ago, Moby. One of my biggest pleasures is to listen to your ethereal and surreal and trance-type music, and I was concerned a little bit. I wasn't sure what you were going to perform, but you did all the dance stuff, all the heavy stuff. It was absolutely wonderful, and that just added an element to our relationship, which, of course, you don't know anything about, that was really exciting for me. And you ended up, your music ended up being a big part of my drive down to Miami in the convertible for my bachelor party as well. So you've been a great part of my life. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark, appreciate your call. Let's get one more right here. Hingham, Massachusetts. Neil is calling. Neil, you're on with Moby.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Moby. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Good.
Wonderful. It's great to talk to you. I've seen you twice. I've seen you down in Miami, down at the Ultra Fest, and you did a DJ set down there, and you were crazy. You were off the wall. I was actually expecting some of your sort of trance and a little laid back, but you climbed the structure two stories up, pumping your fist, air horn, crazy. And then I saw you here in Boston when you did a live show with your band, and it was interesting to see the two different sides of you. And I was also wondering, just because I've been in the scene for 17, 18 years, I haven't been to a rave in quite a while, but still have my turntables. What do you think of the evolution of the scene, you know, raves, underground in warehouses, and now it's EDM and huge and 50,000 people blowing up huge arenas?
Yeah, it's been a very strange process. I mean, I remember the first quasi-rave I ever went to was, I think it was 1989 or 1990, and it was a bar in New York, and some British DJs came over and they gave me a flyer that said, come to New York's first rave. And I think there were maybe 20 people there. Now you have these events like in Tomorrowland in Belgium. They sell 500,000 tickets in less than 2 seconds.
Wow.
Or I'm going to be at Electric Daisy Carnival in a couple of weeks. And same thing. They do about 300,000 people, and it sells out within a minute.
And people want to be part of that enormous crowd.
And on one hand, it's just fascinating to go from like 20 people in a bar to 300,000 people in Las Vegas. But it also, there's a part of it that just makes sense to me, because we've all had that experience of like, we go to see a band and it's four guys, and I'm not maligning bands at all because I've spent a lot of time playing in bands, but you're in a bar, you're watching four guys with guitars, they're playing, there's a couple of lights on them, and it's nice, it's pleasant. But it's not the most compelling thing in the world.
Yeah.
And then you
yeah.
find yourself in the middle of a crowd of 100,000 people with fireworks going off overhead and remarkable pyrotechnics and phenomenal sound and whatever narcotics people might or might not be taking. And I think it's hard, especially if you're 20 years old or 21 years old, it's hard not to get completely
swept
caught up
away,
just in that environment. It's like Cirque du Soleil, but 10 times bigger and completely immersive.
And what determines whether Moby climbs two stories up into the scaffolding or plays it another way on a given night or a given year?
I guess I grew up playing in punk rock bands. And so I think I've just always had that idea that if you're going to put something on stage, it should ideally be, at the very least, as interesting and dynamic as possible. And I don't know, if I'm performing or DJing, I get excited. And if there's scaffolding, maybe it's my monkey, speaking of atavistic DNA, like something kicks in and like the old monkey part of my brain kicks in. And I just want to climb up scaffolding and start yelling.
Just climb. It was quite a journey here. You describe your veganism. You describe really going into the sort of debauched end of the street before you come to this more straight-edged place you are today. I want to look at that with you. We have Moby in the studio today. Singer, songwriter, musician, DJ, photographer, animal rights activist, vegan. He's out with a new memoir. It is called Porcelain. You will remember his great song of that name off the album Play. His memoir tells the story of the years heading toward the global superstardom of Play. We'll come back into it when we come back after a short break. You can join us right here. What do you hear in Moby's story? Can you see how he came to the joy in his music? Are you taking lessons here? Like what? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. We're live streaming on Facebook. Check it out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
to the beat, y'all. The body rock, y'all. So let's rock, y'all. Non-stop, y'all. To the beat, y'all. The body rock, y'all. So let's rock, y'all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with DJ techno rocker star Moby about God, sex, veganism, trance, raves, and how he came up in New York City in the 1990s. Behind us right here, Body Rock off the 1999 play. It was a super hit all over the world. Kind of wrote it when he was down and out and wondering if he would ever go there. Well, he did. In a huge way, he's with us today. You can join us. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. The kid, 10 years old, listening to Diana Ross in the cold car while his mom did laundry and smoked the Winston inside, became a big, big star. And most of that in a New York City quite different from today. We've got questions about that and questions from our listeners. Rebecca in Decatur, Georgia. You are on the air with Moby. Thank you for calling, Rebecca.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Moby, I'm a huge listener of yours, and I want to thank you for everything that you do to create a more humane, sustainable, healthy planet. I work with the Humane Society of the United States, and we appreciate your unending efforts.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I was actually talking to, I was doing a thing in Philadelphia last night, and I was saying how one thing that, one of my goals in life is to not have a career.
But to have a...
What I mean by that is, like, I make music because I love making music.
Yeah.
And I write because I love writing. I hope that I can just work on these things for the love of doing them, as opposed to trying to sort of further some sort of personal brand or have a career. Like the criteria for evaluating creative output should just be the quality and the integrity of the creative output, not mm-hmm. necessarily trying to further materialistic
the
goals.
The structure of a particular success.
Yeah. But I do have a job, and my job is animal welfare. You know, like I make music, I write, I love doing that, but my day job, as far as I'm concerned, what I wake up thinking about every day is animal rights and animal welfare. Like, that's my life's work.
Is it related to your veganism? Which came first? Are they the same thing?
Well, I grew up, like most people, loving animals. But paradoxically, and maybe someone can relate to this, up until the time I was 19, I loved animals deeply, but I also ate at Burger King.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was around 19, I had this, what I think of as like my Saul on the road to Damascus moment with animals, where I was petting a rescue cat. And I realized that this rescue cat named Tucker had two eyes and a central nervous system and a very rich emotional life and a deep desire to avoid pain.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, I sort of neurologically extrapolated and realized every animal, as far as I'm concerned, has two eyes, a central nervous system, a rich emotional life, and a deep desire to avoid pain. And at that point, I became a vegan. So I've been a vegan now for about 28 years and an animal rights activist for 3 decades.
No more Burger King burgers or any burgers.
Not for me, no.
Period.
Yeah.
And animal rights right out front. 1996, your album was Animal Rights. You had your background in punk rock music. Just as electronic was really taking off, you went back to that a bit with Animal Rights, embracing punk rock. Here's a little bit of that. That's When I Reach for My Revolver. This is a cover of the song by Mission of Burma. Moby.
Father taught us boundaries, the knowledge we must go. I'm trying to protect my unity. That's when I reach for my revolver. That's when it all gets blown away.
Moby, That's When I Reach for My Revolver, 1996. This turned out to be a misstep. Explain what happened.
Well, it's funny because that particular song, it's a cover from a band called Mission of Burma, who were from Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So oddly enough, Boston is one of the only places in the world where people might recognize that song.
Yes,
because it actually did get played on the radio here just because Mission of Burma were this beloved local band.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was 1996, and I thought that part of being a musician was doing things differently at times. You know, like earlier you mentioned Lou Reed. So Lou Reed made Metal Machine music.
Mm-hmm.
John Lennon made Revolution No. 9 in the Plastic Ono Band. And I'm not comparing myself with these greats, but I'm just saying I thought that part of a musician's job description was to just try different things.
I mean, you had this quote from Rambo taped to your mirror. I is another seems to be inspiring toward that.
Yeah, this idea that, like, I never wanted a career, you know, which is not in any way to malign the idea of having a career, but I just wanted to dedicate myself to the idea of making music and trying to make music that resonated with me emotionally and to hopefully make music that would resonate with other people emotionally.
Are you saying that you knew that the world or sales were going deeper toward electronic, but you deliberately turned away from that? Or was it just kind of just happened?
It was a little of both. Because by 1996, the Prodigy were selling millions of records, and the Chemical Brothers and Fatboy Slim.
Yes.
And they were all suddenly like
the thing,
platinum records. And I went to this other extreme and made a very dark, very disturbing punk rock record called Animal Rights that my managers were dismayed by, because they thought that I was,
come on,
like,
man,
like the ring was it within my grasp.
Yeah,
like
there
all
it
I
is.
Had to do was make a techno record, and instead I went to this sort of perverse other direction and made this very noisy, dark punk rock record. Managed to alienate almost. Yeah, apart from some people in Boston, I managed to alienate almost everyone.
You described going from that straight white kid in the suburbs to a pretty debauched guy in terms of sex and drugs, I guess right around this time. What was the album made in response to that or out of that?
A little bit. I mean, so this in the memoir Porcelain, the first half of the book, I'm a Christian, sober dance music person.
Mm-hmm.
Then halfway through the book, I start drinking.
Flip the switch, yeah.
Question my faith, start dating questionable people and make this really noisy punk rock record. So the only thing I can think of is there's this ongoing sort of like personal existential question that I assume we all ask ourselves, which is that simple question, like who, and it's a very self-evident question, like who are we and who am I? And so in the beginning of my musical life, I was a Christian electronic music guy, but I wanted to know, like, that clearly wasn't the core of my identity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like why we go on vacation. You know, like we know who we are at home, but do we know who we will be in Sumatra? Do we know who we'll be
on pilgrimage?
Yeah, and so we go somewhere, and like then you have a better sense of yourself in a markedly different context or markedly different circumstances. And I think that's part of what inspired me in the late 90s going to this other extreme of like,
this
drinking
the,
and taking
the
drugs.
The hero's journey or the search or the
sort
the,
of
your odyssey.
Like a, and it was a very sad odyssey because I was suddenly, I had gone from playing festivals to 50,000 people to when I was touring for Animal Rights, playing venues that held 100 people, having 50 people show up, and by the end of the show, maybe 20 people were left. So it was, but then it led to the making of the album Play, which was also, I guess, confusing to people.
You went the other way. You made this album when you, as I read you, you'd kind of given up or thought, well, that was great, but now something else.
Yeah, by the end of the 90s, I was convinced that my career was over. I'd lost my record deal.
Yeah.
I was having constant panic attacks. I was hungover all the time.
Yeah.
I was broke. I thought I was going to have to, like, go get a job teaching community college, which wouldn't have been bad. Like, I have great respect for anyone, any teacher.
You'd be great at it.
You know, because I'd been a philosophy major, so I thought I'd go to a community college somewhere in New England, teach philosophy to bored students. And then I made this album Play, which was supposed to be my last record because I didn't have a record deal. And I just thought I was making this record and maybe
a few somebody,
people would hear it. And then how odd and surprising that it ended up having the life that it had.
It went absolutely huge all over the world. Signature song off that album, one you initially didn't even want on the album, Porcelain. It's the name of the memoir. It was the name of the great hit from Moby, 1999, off Play, Porcelain. Moby is with me in the studio. Check it out on Facebook live stream right now at On Point Radio. William is calling from St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. William, you're on with Moby.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Moby. I just wanted to say Having listened, to Moby through the 90s and hearing that song they just played, paired with the movie The Beach when that came out, I drew a great deal of inspiration from just the visuals of that scene where that song kicks in and they're panning over the island, and just the scenery of all that natural beauty inspired me to move where I am now in the Virgin Islands. And I just wanted to say thanks for that inspiration.
Are you living the dream, William?
I sure am.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm glad that I had a small part to play in that.
Thanks for calling from the Virgin Islands, William. We're all jealous now, but we're in the music. Matthew in Portland, Maine. Matthew, you're on with Moby.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I saw Moby with Elton John at the Arena in Verona, Italy, which is a Colosseum in a little better condition because it's a little newer, but still about 2,800 years old, I reckon. And two things. It's the closest I ever had to a religious experience, and because of that, I'm actually fearful of ever seeing Moby again because it was a magical moment. That brought me into trance and all of that. Before that, I was pretty much just a Hesher from the suburbs listening to heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
So well, thank you, Moby.
My pleasure. And I'm a Hesher from the suburbs listening to heavy metal right now. Yeah, it's funny. I had a similar experience. I went to see Neil Young play recently.
Yeah.
And he was on stage, just him, for about 2.5 hours playing piano, playing guitar, talking about his hits and playing, everything from Helpless and After the Gold Rush.
Yes, yes.
And then afterwards, someone said, "Oh, do you want to go backstage and meet Neil Young?" And I was like, "Oh, no.
Could not.
Because he might be the nicest man in the world, but what if I get him on a bad day and he's not nice?
Yeah.
I compromise my love for all these songs. So I completely understand. Like, I'd rather hold on to my love for something than run the risk of challenging it. So all I can say is if he ever comes to see me again, the man we were just talking to from Portland.
Mm.
And also, as a tangent, why are so many mystery writers based out of Maine? Think of like John Connolly.
Stephen King.
Like, I mean, Maine's
that rocky coast.
Yeah, Maine's an amazing place, but how is it that it's been involved? Like, it's one of 50 states. Like, I've never read like a dark mystery novel set in Wyoming. Why Maine of all the places? I just finished reading a John Connolly book.
Yeah.
And I feel like I just spent a month in Maine.
I love it. Inquiring minds, Moby's mind wants to know. We're talking with Moby. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A caller from Maine said, couldn't go to your concert again because it was a religious experience last time. There's something about trance that comes close to spirituality. It takes us out into that spot. Do you get that a lot? People listen to your music and they say, oh, this is part of my spiritual life.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the single best things of having this weird life as a musician is when people come to me and tell me how my music has found a place in their lives. And for some reason, a lot of people seem to play my music at funerals.
Mm.
And so it happens quite a lot. And it's so beautiful, and I feel so honored that people will involve me in these intimate parts of their life. Like, I'll have someone come to me and say, like, they were in hospice with their grandmother, and while she was dying, they were listening to my music, and it was a really beautiful experience.
And why do you think they do that?
I mean, the only thing I can think of is my goal as a musician. I don't always succeed. Maybe I don't even often succeed. But my goal is to make music that has an honesty to it and a vulnerability to it,
mm-hmm.
and ideally even a sense of beauty to it. And maybe at times I've succeeded in doing that. That's mm-hmm. the only thing I can think of. Because I think a lot of music, especially in our world, a lot of music is exciting, or it's ironic,
sure.
or it's cynical, or
mm-hmm.
it's calculated, mm-hmm. or it's mercenary. But sadly, there's not a lot of music that has that quality of vulnerability to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not even saying I'm good at what I do, but I've really aspired to making music that does have an honest vulnerability to it.
I love the way you've kept that and kept the joy in it. We Are All Made of Stars was 2002 off the album 18. You said you wrote it after the attacks on 9/11 as a message of hope and solidarity.
People that fall apart. No one can stop us now. 'Cause we are made of stars.
I can't get to it. Not enough time. But Pedro in Colorado wants to know where your music goes next. Where you see this school of music going next?
Well, I mean, I have to be realistic. I'm 50 years old. I've been making records for 26 years. It's 2016.
Yes, it is.
No one buys records. So I'm finishing an album now that I'm going to put out in September. And I'm making it for the simple reason that I love making records. I really don't expect anyone to buy it. And if someone listens to it, that's great. But there are billions of pieces of music for people to listen to. So if someone will make the effort to listen to a new record of mine, that's wonderful, but I certainly don't expect it. So putting out records as a 50-year-old man in 2016, I'm not kidding myself and saying that, like, I'm at my most relevant. Like, it would be absurd for me at this age to think that I am, but I still love making records.
So why not do it?
Yeah, so just make records, write books, do these things, put them out there. And I also love what I think of as this, like, egalitarian chaos of the internet, where you release something, mm-hmm. you put it out into the world, you have no expectations, and you simply see what happens. Like, it's this dialectic, you know, and it's especially with this book, with Porcelain, because it's very personal, and I'm trying to be as honest as I possibly can. And so it's not just putting something I've made out there, it's sort of ostensibly putting myself out there, and then seeing how people respond to it.
The memoir is Porcelain. It's pretty terrific. Moby, it's been great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks. It's been really fun.
We'll go out with Rock the House. Moby put it out in his 1993 compilation album, Early Underground. If you're watching this interview on Facebook Live, stick around. Moby and I will be talking directly to you, your questions and comments. If you aren't, head over to Facebook and join us. Thanks for listening today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.